I'm delighted now to welcome David Stewart McLean. He's author of the book, The Answer to the Riddle is Me, a memoir of amnesia. And he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe tonight at 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So at the beginning of this rather amazing book, we meet you. You are waking up, standing in a train station in India, having no idea who you are, where you live, or anything else. What happened next?
You know, for this brief moment when I woke up, and if you haven't been to an Indian railway station recently, there's a lot of chaos because people are rushing into the train and people are rushing out, and there's just so much stuff going on. And in this brief moment when I first woke up, it was sort of just sort of data. It was just all this sort of sensory data that I had, but I had no narrative, no context to be able to sort that data. And so I think about that a lot, that how much of our narrative, our life narrative, is just a way for us to make a hierarchy of data. And so for a while, it was actually just sort of like my brain had been dilated and I was just swallowing all the world's data. And it wasn't until I realized that I needed to do something next that I started to freak out. Because in order to do something next, I needed to know what I was going to do. And if I didn't have the information of who I was, I had no idea what I was going to do. That's when I started to panic, and that's when I started to get terrified. And luckily, a tourist police officer named Rajesh came and found me and told me that he was used to finding foreigners like me on drugs on his platform, and that he was going to take care of me.
And in the subsequent days, first you were taken to the home of somebody who dealt with foreigners who had taken too many drugs and were out of it, and then you were put in a mental hospital. This is all in Hyderabad, India. And it was determined that you were having an allergic reaction to an anti-malaria drug called Larium, which has been called, as you write, the Agent Orange of our time. What were the effects of that drug on you and at that time and in the years that followed?
So what it turns out is that when I first got the test back, my blood tests and my MRIs and stuff, the allergic reaction was just a working theory. And it turns out that's not true. It's not an allergic reaction. Instead, it's a known side effect of the drug, which is kind of intense to think that that's a known side effect of the drug. Suicide is a known side effect of the drug. Depression, anxiety, paranoia, and confusion, all side effects of the drug, as well as vestibular side effects such as vertigo, tinnitus. And so, like, the brain, if you're the specific kind of person that the mefloquine Larium can pass through the blood-brain barrier and pool in your brain, it works as this potent neurotoxin and just kills brain cells.
And so the effects of that, in your case, were very intense. Can you describe them?
I had intense hallucinations. I had amnesia, but it wasn't sort of a constant amnesia. What it was like my brain was spasming, and there would be times where I'd remember things and times where I wouldn't remember anything and times where I'd remember everything and times where it would all be gone. And that's sort of why I chose to write the book like I did, that there are parts of the book where it seems like I know things and parts of the book where I'm just lost. And that's sort of really important for me to get at that exact truth of how that experience felt, which is, it was almost worse than just Fred Flintstone amnesia, because the moments when I did have something come back to me, I didn't know how long I'd have it before I'd lose it again.
Did you have the intense need to write it down when you did remember?
When I first woke up in the asylum, I thought I was being given a pop quiz by God, and I thought the whole world was giving me clues. And so I would draw all over the newspaper and try to make connections in the newspaper as if newspapers were a coded source that were seeking to send me messages on what the thing was. And so when I get to my apartment later and I find all of my books, and in all of the books I have, there are footnotes, there's marginalia, so it seems like I'm always a person who's trying to break down and figure out what's going on.
It's interesting that you were, when you were talking earlier about, I mean, you were in the train station and there was all this data coming in and you're trying to make sense of it. And then you have the newspaper and you feel like it's trying to tell you something. There's a really striking passage to me in the book, and I'm going to quote from that. You said it's a bit later in your story, but you wrote, "As long as there was chaos, I was okay. It was when everything congealed into a meaning-making machine producing feelings of unity within the world. If a moment like that came, then I should be worried." Explain what you mean by that and what that experience was like.
So at one point I had these auditory hallucinations of music. I had this music going, and everybody in the world around me, and this included like the ambulance men, these two gentlemen who came to help me in the guest house, and the nurses, everybody seemed choreographed by the music, and everything they did was part of the music, and that was terrifying. It was terrifying that there was this song that was uniting the world, and that's when I realized, oh, this is what craziness is. This is legitimate craziness. Chaos, in some ways, is safer than everything making sense. When everything makes sense, that's when I get worried, because it means that some sort of intense hallucination is over-ordering the world.
It's funny, because sometimes people seek out some of the experiences that you had on purpose. Like, they'll put on Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, and The Wizard of Oz at the same time, and they go together. Or they'll seek out, through meditation, things like, well, an experience that you had, which was becoming one with the universe, becoming one with everything around you. But in your case, it was not a good experience at all, on the contrary.
Right. It felt like I was sloshing out into the world, that I was just sort of, I was dissolving into the world, and that wasn't a pleasant experience. Because in some ways, like, I needed the container of me to hold whatever that was. And if the container of me failed, then I was gone. And sometimes people in those aspirational states, the people who want to experience that state, call it an ego death. And that's sort of what it felt like. I was able to see myself objectively. I was able to experience myself without myself getting in the way, which seems needlessly complicated. But that is sort of the way it felt.
So you began to piece together the facts of your life. You would look at photographs of family and friends. There were photographs of yourself with various girlfriends. You didn't know who they were. You didn't know what their names were, what your relationship was. But almost like a journalist, you started to recover that information. Did you recover the memories really with them, or was it more like a journalistic reconstruction of your life?
I think it's both of those. Sometimes I feel like I've recovered the memories, and sometimes the stories I've constructed about the photographs are in some ways more real than any memory I might have had. And I'm not sure it's that different from the way other people look at photographs. I think photographs become their own sort of myth, their own sort of legend in our lives outside of the moment itself. What I tried to do when I was looking at those photographs was sort of using the character of me, the character that I was learning about all the time from my parents, from my sisters, from friends, I tried to construct the scene in which this character of me was participating. And sometimes that would evoke a memory, and sometimes the story was enough, and I was able to just say, now I know what I was doing in that parking lot with that woman with the remarkable nose.
And there's a kind of interesting honesty that came from that. There was a girlfriend that you had, and you looked at your pictures with her, and you said, well, I don't know exactly who she is, but I don't think I really like her that much because I seem to be distant and looking away in the pictures of her. And I thought there's a kind of honesty and basically kind of rational looking at the facts without your emotion for this person getting in the way of knowing what the reality was. It was kind of poignant and interesting.
Yeah, I was able to see that in a lot of pictures I had with this specific person, I was always looking away. I was looking out of the frame, and I was able to say, you know, maybe this isn't good for either of us. And she is. She is the only person who came to visit me when I was in Ohio, when I was recovering. She's this remarkable person, but in some ways I could tell objectively that the relationship wasn't going to work out.
Now, the part of the book in which you describe those early days after you woke up and then you went back to Ohio with your parents, it's very visual, very sensory writing. Were your senses heightened when you lost the informational part of your mind?
Yeah, sometimes I think about it, and excuse me if I'm nerding out a little bit too much, but I think about it like Matt Murdock, who's Daredevil in Marvel Comics, and he lost his vision, you know, by being hit by a radioactive isotope, as that happens in comics. But all of his other senses were sort of heightened. And in some ways, that's the way it felt. It felt like I was sort of super sensory engaged in the world. When you don't have a narrative context, you don't know how to sort that data. And so any data can be the most important data. The birds on the windowsill can be incredibly important data. Anything. And India is full of data. And so it was a lot of me not knowing which data to put faith in.
As you got your memory and your kind of cognitive faculties back, did that recede?
Yeah, without a doubt. It's one of the things that I find really interesting is how much of daily life we treat like triage, that we just have our errands and we have these things that we need, and we sort of, our brain sort of eliminates all of the data that doesn't correspond to those errands, those chores, those whatever, those immediate needs, when there's so much more data out there. And that sort of fascinates me, is how much data am I missing when I go to Walmart to buy a bag of Cheetos and I just only see Cheeto information.
And it's funny, too, because I think we filter out a lot of ugliness on purpose. For example, if you live in a kind of horrible, filthy, noisy city, your mind filters that out on purpose. But then when you go to places, if those filters are still on that are beautiful, it's that much harder to see them and take them in.
Yeah. Because you still have those. It's funny because when you live for a long time in a place where everybody speaks a language that you don't, and then you fly back and you end up in the Detroit airport, like suddenly everything's so loud because all of your ear filters have been removed. Because when you're in a country where everybody's speaking a language you don't understand, you stop, you just hear everything as noise. You hear everything as just sonic data that can mean something, cannot mean something. You just sort of open your ears more. And then as soon as you get to the Detroit International Airport, you immediately have to reconstruct those filters.
Very interesting. Now, there are some horrifying stories about therapists who didn't listen to you. Tell us some of those stories. I mean, one of them was responsible for sending you back to India, where you were a Fulbright scholar, who really didn't listen to virtually anything you said about your mental state.
Yeah, in some ways, I feel like he was doing his job, which was to fill out a form. And that's what he was asked to do, is to fill out a form. And I thought we were actually having a conversation. But he was actually just filling out a form to say it's okay for me to go back. And what everybody thought, you know, to be charitable, everybody thought that it was like food poisoning, that once I had the drug out of my system, that I would be fine. And they didn't realize that, as we now know, like, Larium has this incredible half-life that can stay in the brain for up to and over a decade. The other theory is that it's just a neurotoxin. It just kills brain cells, and so you no longer have those parts of your brain. So, like, for this guy, he just was looking at a form that he had to fill out, and the fact that I was crying and losing it in his office didn't mean anything in terms of the form he was filling out. He just wanted to make sure I was mentally competent to go back to India, not emotionally competent.
Do you think you were?
What I did in order to go back to India was, you know, I'd woken up and I'd been told I was a drug addict, and then I was taking to a woman's house where she told me that I was breaking my mother's heart by doing drugs, all of which wasn't true, but to them it was true, and to me it was true at that moment. And so I felt, when I woke up in the asylum, like the biggest failure in the world. I felt haunted by failure in the way that when you walk through a spider web, even when you wipe it off of your face, you can still feel it on your face.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt this tremendous failure. And so I didn't want to lose this fellowship. And so I did whatever I had to do, including telling everybody I was okay in order to go back. In the long run, it turns out that was the most brilliant, stupid decision I've ever made in my life.
What do you mean?
If I had stayed in Ohio, I would have been confronted every day with things that I didn't know but should know. Like, I couldn't go to the grocery store across the street without bumping into people who knew me, and I would feel that absence every time I would go over there. But in India, especially in the Tarnaka section of Secunderabad, where I was living, I didn't know anything, and nobody expected me to know anything. In fact, people went out of their way to tell the blonde guy in Secunderabad that I knew nothing. And that was sort of freeing, because then I could just concentrate on rebuilding my personality, rebuilding a lot of foundational stuff. If I stayed in Central Ohio, I'm convinced I would have killed myself, because I would have just become so depressed at being a failure.
I mean, I think it's also fascinating, and in a way, it's kind of, I imagine, a kind of adaptive trait that we have as human beings or as human animals, that you don't really want people to see how bad off you are, how much you're suffering, and the people around you who had preconceived ideas of who you were really didn't lose those ideas and therefore didn't really see you. And meanwhile, you had learned to compensate and to pretend and to learn what it looks like when people recognize you so that you can pretend that you recognize them. And at the same time, on some level, you so longed to be seen for the vulnerable state you were in and to be taken care of.
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of just wish someone else would take care of me for a long time, because it was terrifying. I thought it was ridiculous that my parents would let me drive a car. I couldn't understand that they didn't know how bad off I was, but I was also telling them I was fine at the same time, because I definitely didn't want to go back to the asylum, but I also didn't have the language to talk about it, to talk about what was going on with me. And I think it's also, you know, when you're not well, you become a chore and an errand for all those people around you, and that becomes tiring for a person. And so you sometimes just want to be okay so they can stop worrying. And I wanted my parents to stop worrying. I wanted them to feel like I was okay. And so I told them I was okay. My parents and I have talked about this often, and if I was 18, they would never have let me go back to India. But since I was 28 and an adult, there was just a default assumption of competence. And so they just thought I was in my right mind.
So now it's more than a decade later. What was the process like of writing this book? And were you kind of working on it all along, or did you start that much later?
I think I was working on it without being aware I was working on it for a long time. I would write stories where people had lost gaps of time, either through prison or through drug use or through bad relationships. I wrote a lot of stories that sort of dealt with missing time in a person's life. And it wasn't until, like, I was finishing up my PhD that I was like, oh, I'm not writing the thing that I'm supposed to be writing. I'm writing around the thing I'm trying to write about. And it wasn't until I finally had a great therapist that I had a pretty big breakthrough in being able to talk about it. But my first attempts at writing about it were all about being funny and it being like a funny anecdote, this wild ride through India and New Mexico. And I had to peel that away, because, like, being funny, anecdote in some ways is a way of controlling the story and not letting the story get close to hurting you again. when you tell an anecdote, you know exactly how it's going to end. You know all the little bits, and you know the audience reaction to it. And in some ways, like, it's a damaging mechanism because you act like you have control of it, but the emotional heft still sits inside of you, outside of the anecdote. And so I had to learn to strip away the anecdote. I had to learn to strip away the need for me to be charming, for me to be liked, for me to think I was smart, for me to any of this stuff, and instead just write the truth of the experience.
Well, it's extraordinary writing on multiple levels. It's, first of all, very honest. There's no self-pity that I could detect, nor do you hide things about yourself that are maybe not so beautiful or that other people might want to hide. And it's also just really beautifully written. The way you use language and similes gives the person reading it. I mean, by the end of the day that I spent reading this book, I felt like I'd been crazy myself and I'd lost my memory myself. I mean, it brought me kind of viscerally into the experience. And I would imagine that writing it, you would have had to be strong enough to re-experience that yourself.
Yeah, when I was writing this, I had a little office above a 7-Eleven, and there was no windows in this office. It was about the size of an overfed broom closet, and so I would go and I would sit there for 8 to 12 hours a day and just try to write and rewrite this thing again and again. I wrote the first 50 pages 9 times until I got to a place where I felt like I could proceed, and I had found the right tone and the right way to move forward.
Well, the work definitely paid off. It's a wonderful book. I hope that a lot of people actually read it. You also had a piece on This American Life about it, which I suspect a lot of people heard. Did you get a lot of feedback from that?
Yeah, I got a lot of feedback from people both who had a lot of experience with mefloquine and similar experiences. And one of the terrifying things about telling my story is finding out how lucky I was. So many people have committed suicide on this drug. So many people are hobbled by this drug. The FDA just this last July said that some of its physical side effects might become permanent. And so people will have permanent vertigo and permanent tinnitus and permanent vestibular issues for the rest of their lives. And that's terrifying.
It's also terrifying that there has been so little outcry about the drug, or relatively little outcry. One of the horrifying uses of this drug is the way it was used on prisoners in Guantanamo.
Yeah, that was, it's being called pharmaceutical waterboarding. And it was found during a discovery for this lawyer, Seton Hall professor, who was doing a discovery for one of his clients. And there was this sudden uptick in suicides at Guantanamo. And so, you know, the government dumped data onto this guy during the discovery phase of the trial. And he started finding out these prisoners, upon arriving at Guantanamo, before they'd even been tested for malaria, were given a dose 5 times the normal dose of mefloquine, malarium. And Cuba doesn't have malaria. None of the soldiers who were working at Guantanamo were taking mefloquine, larium, and none of the contractors were either. So it's being posited that what people were looking for were the side effects to sort of disorient and confuse and make the prisoners paranoid and then more pliable to being able to be interrogated, which is terrifying.
Yeah, and I mean, think about the long-term mental and physical consequences of this drug that you describe in your book, 5 times that normal dose on people who have not been convicted of any crime, who were prisoners, is, there's no words for it. It's unbelievable.
Like, it was a horror show, and I was surrounded by people who wanted good things for me, right? It was a really life-changing, horrible experience for me, and, like, everyone around me wanted me to get better. I can't imagine how awful it is for those prisoners. It's one of the terrifying things about this book, and the sort of DOD, Department of Defense, on one hand, denying its soldiers that anything was wrong with mefloquine, and it kept prescribing mefloquine, and on the other hand, force-feeding it to prisoners for the side effects that they denied were there. It's incredible.
So how are you after 12 years? Do you feel that there are still effects of this drug in your system, in your brain?
There are things that are there that had never been there before. I still have insomnia. I have panic attacks. I have depression. And none of that was there before.
David Stewart McLean is author of the book, The Answer to the Riddle Is Me, A Memoir of Amnesia. And once again, he will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock right here in Santa Fe, signing copies of the book. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you so much.